Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hello, I'm Larry Mueller, and today we welcome Jim Nienhuis, UW-Madison Professor of Horticulture, gardening haiku poet, to the microphone, and soon to be with us, she's not here yet, but Lisa Johnson, Dane County UW Extension Horticulture Educator, will be with us as well. And here, of course, to talk about what's going on out there in the garden. And I hope you'll join in with your questions and comments as we move along today. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us, and the email address is talk@wpr.org. Jim Nienhuis, welcome back. Thanks for being with us again.
Oh, it's great to be here again, Larry.
You have just spent a rather hectic week or so. I thought it was kind of interesting welcoming some students from another country to look at gardens here in Wisconsin.
Well, actually, it's a true exchange program that we have. We've developed a new course here at UW. Ironically, the Department of Horticulture is partnering with the Department of Latin American, Caribbean, and Iberian Studies, of all things. Mm-hmm. And we created a new course called Organic Sustainable Agriculture in the Tropics. And part of our course will be during spring break, our students will they'll go through a semester-long colloquium on organic mm-hmm. sustainable agriculture topics. And during spring break, our students will travel to Central America to view organic and sustainable agriculture farms. But one of our partner institutions in Central America, it's the Instituto Tecnológico in Costa Rica, and they established a course.
Same course, kind of.
Same course, except, of course, it's called Organic Sustainable Agriculture in Temperate Climates. And so they sent up a group of students to visit with us. So I've been traveling around all week visiting farms, saw a lot of late blight, saw a lot of other great vegetables. Yeah. But, what's so much fun for me is that we all are victims of our perceptions of what the rest of the world is like. And I think they expected to find, a glacier with a couple of pine trees sticking out from under a rock. And so their first Saturday here, what did we do? We took the 80 bus over and we went to the farmer's market.
In Madison.
And every one of their jaws just dropped. They could not believe, the variety of vegetables, which ironically is really a much broader spectrum of vegetables than they are used to seeing in Costa Rica, for certainly. And so it was quite exciting, although I did get back pretty late last night. So if I sound a little hoarse on the radio today, I dropped them off at O'Hare Airport and then drove here and got back at 1:45 a.m.
Well, you won't fall asleep.
No.
The people will keep you going here. You did mention, Jim, that as you went and traveled around some of the farms, the vegetable farms, you saw some a potato blight.
Oh, indeed. Yeah, several of the farms that we visited, an array of different organic, sustainable farms in Dane County and outside of Dane County as well. And certainly there was some. This really is, in my mind, everyone has opinions, and I think there are a lot of urban legends about mm-hmm. this as well. But at least, my urban legend and bias is that really this is the perfect storm, right? We had very cool, wet weather, right?
Yeah.
And so it was like, this wasn't Madison, Wisconsin. This was basically Ireland, right? Mm-hmm. All spring long. We have a lot of susceptible cultivars out there. And one way or another, and those are mostly where the urban legends come from, somewhere a new fungal strain came in, and this is probably Phytophthora that has come in. Although, I'll have to say, it's not only that disease. There's also a lot of others. There's my garden, for example, out at Eagle Heights. I don't not have late blight, but I do have a lot of alternaria. I have the early blights and septorias. So really, when you get cool, wet weather, you're going to get it. Yeah, it's the perfect storm. So everyone thinks, well, heavens, we're going to have this for the next 20 years, but next summer will be 1,000 degrees and we won't have any of that. So you have to have those three conditions. You have to have the susceptible variety, the perfect environment, and then a pathogen, a virulent pathogen. And that's what we had this summer.
Well, Ruth in Washera County has a question for you, I believe, about carrots. Let's go to Ruth. Hi, Ruth.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've heard a contradiction on, like, long storage of carrots if you don't have necessarily a root cellar.
Sure.
And I've heard that some have talked about, you know, finding the coolest spot in your basement, and some say sawdust, some say sand. And I'm kind of wondering, because I've got a newer variety that I tried, and it's fantastic, and I would love
to. Oh, you've got, but you grew a Nance, huh?
Actually, it's a Nelson.
A Nelson? Well, that's close. You know, that sounds Nance, Nelson. Come on, that's pretty much the same
thing.
It's
a Nance type.
Yeah,
yes,
sure.
It's a Nance
one of those
type.
High sugar types. Absolutely. You know what? This is a topic that's really near and dear to my heart, because if there's one thing that I am really passionate about, is about local foods and local vegetables. And I think, maybe you could agree with me, I think that they ought to change the actually the building codes completely in Wisconsin. No, they must. I think they should change the building codes to require a root cellar.
I agree.
Wow. Okay, we agree on that. Because we had, you know, I'm a farm boy. We grew up on a vegetable farm just outside of Chicago. And, you know, we did this. We stored our vegetables. And we did all of the above. We stored them in straw for the most part.
Okay.
I don't think we did it in, I don't remember us ever doing it in sand. But we did store our vegetables. And as long as we could keep them above freezing and at a, you know, reasonably low temperature, we could have vegetables well into at least Christmas. I know our Christmas dinner was always fresh vegetables, and those always came out of our root cellar.
Yep.
So I think that's just a terrific thing to do. How do you think we could change the law to require root cellars?
Well,
I mean, wouldn't that promote
plans that would entail like boxing in a cold corner, unheated corner, and insulating and putting some shelves in that way, but there's also the thing with carrots, they don't want any moisture.
Yeah, I think that's why we did carrots for sure, and many other vegetables in our root cellar. The other thing I remember my father doing is in the basement, he would hang up the tomato plants, right? And they would just, I mean, the entire plant with the fruit on them. He would just hang them in the basement just before the first frost. And we would harvest tomatoes out of our basement for a couple of weeks after that. So I can remember storing vegetables. I just think it's a terrific thing that we have somehow drifted away from, you know, because of the availability of, you know, transportation. And we can go to any grocery store and get anything we want at any time. But I think root cellars are just... I mean, that's what vegetables are all about. That's the good life.
Thanks, Ruth.
Well, can I ask just one question quick?
Sure, go ahead.
I heard this late blight, when you were talking about it, that brought to mind here. What is the main identification when you're looking at your garden? Because I have one variety of tomatoes that's not looking so hot, and everything else looks fantastic, but when I look at the guideline where I purchase my seeds, that's one variety that didn't have all the nice little symbols behind it for the resistance.
All the capital letters after the name of the variety, right?
And I'm just wondering, what is the thing you're looking at? Does it just look like it's completely dried up?
Yeah, it seems to really, you know, it's a big, like, alternaria. Some of the other diseases tend to be sort of spotty, or they have a... Some of the things that I'm seeing have halos, but this late blight, you know, like the entire leaf seems to be taken out. Although it doesn't seem to affect the fruit as much as I had expected.
No.
The fruit's fine, even though there's a blight. The fruit should be fine.
Well, the plant looks like, those two look like they haven't had any water. It looks like they're in a desert.
Right.
And everything else looks great.
That sounds to me, you know, that means... To the best I can do, diagnostics of disease over the radio. That sounds like our likely culprit. But again, I think that, you know, most of our varieties are susceptible. So we have to be, you know, sensitive to the fact that, you know, when you have a cool, wet year, you're going to get hit by something. On the other hand, you know, as Irwin always, you know, says to me, you know, I have such a Zen approach to vegetable growing. You know, I accept these losses. You know, I'm willing to accept a few losses because... you know, look at what a, you know, she's talking about her carrots. What a wonderful year it has been for, I mean, I'm looking at beets out there that are just, you know, beyond belief in terms of their, you know, they're magnificent. Okay. All the cool season vegetables, the brassicas are doing exceptionally well. And for some bizarre reason, unexpected to me, cantaloupes and watermelons are doing well.
Right.
I thought that those would be delayed because of the relatively low temperatures, but even on some of the CSAs that we were visiting, they're saying, oh, heavens, our watermelons are like, you know, this is a great year. Yeah, they're having a great year for them, and they're not being hit by the powdery or the downy mildews, so they're just doing really well. So it's a good year. You know, every year is going to be great for one vegetable and poor for another.
Poor for another.
That's the Zen approach to vegetable growing.
Thanks, Ruth. Thanks for calling. Let's go to Paul in Duluth, Minnesota. Paul, hello to you.
Hi, guys. Hey, Jim.
Yeah.
First of all, I have questions about Brussels sprouts and planting garlic, but you were kind enough to send me Wisconsin Wosta seeds. And I live up here on the north shore of Minnesota, and it has been a cool and damp summer, and I must announce to you that they did not survive.
Oh no!
I did my very best, but I don't think the soil ever warmed up enough for them to really
take off. Yeah.
But anyway.
But you know, I can balance. I'll tell you this: I'm going to balance that comment with the just before the show started of all. Jim Packard came over and told me that in his CSA box that he got Wisconsin Roaster. So I was trying to scribble down a haiku about that, and maybe I'll work on that a little bit over the over the break. But the fact that Jim Packard is having Wisconsin Wostas, and he's probably going to prepare a chile relleno this weekend, you know, is that's the ultimate. You lost your Wisconsin Roasters, but just the knowledge that Jim Packard has Wisconsin Roasters in his CSA box is you know, balances that out for me.
Well, I'm glad somebody is having better luck than I did. Now, this is the first year I have tried to plant Brussels sprouts, and I have five quite healthy-looking plants. They have beautiful purple leaves. And what I'm noticing is that the lower leaves, one at a time, are turning kind of a bright red, and they literally are dropping off from the bottom. But I still have a really healthy crown and new growth coming up at the top. Is that the way Brussels sprouts grow?
You know, I'm trying to have a capture my mental image of the Brussels sprout. First of all, I'll say this has got to be, you know, a terrific year for Brussels sprouts. In fact, I saw quite a few of those when we were traveling with the students last week, and certainly all the brassicas. The Brussels sprouts are going to come in. This is a great vegetable, the Brussels sprout. We used to grow it on our farm, you know, when I was a boy. And that was one of the things that we would leave in the field, and that's one that you would leave in the field until it actually frosted, because that's when they would get sweet, right? You'd get the sugars in them. So that was always our Thanksgiving vegetable, Brussels sprouts.
I'm noticing little bumps starting to form right above where those lower leaves are falling off. So I'm thinking those are going to be the sprouts.
Indeed, they will be.
Growing up the stalk.
They're like tiny little cabbages on lateral, you know, on lateral branches rather than on a terminal bud. I mean, what is a cabbage? A cabbage is a giant terminal bud, right, where it wraps these giant leafy, you know, waxy leaves around this giant terminal bud. But the Brussels sprouts, I don't know, it's kind of a...
Love Brussels sprouts.
It's a new form, right, of that, where you just have little bitty, cabbages growing on every...
Right now they're about the size of a marble.
Yep.
You're going to have great Brussels sprouts.
Okay, so,
I think it's going to be a great year.
Should I feed those?
What's that?
Should I feed those plants or just keep them watered?
Oh, I bet there's not much you're going to do at this point.
Just water. Keep them watered.
All right. Now, on garlic, a couple of weeks ago, my favorite grocery store had a great sale on whole garlic.
Okay.
And I bought 2 pounds or 3 pounds. and made my favorite thing, which is roasted garlic puree.
Ooh.
And what I used were all the big cloves, and I have a dish of the smaller ones, and I would like to plant those. And I've never tried to plant garlic. What do I do?
You know, garlic, now that's great because you can plant garlic basically year-round,
yeah.
Right? I mean, you can plant it anytime you want. I mean, you could put it in right now, and it's going to overwinter.
How deep do you plant them?
See, this is not my forte, how deep. I say deep enough, and they're going to, I mean, if you put them in the soil, yeah, cover them up, and they're going to sprout, right? I mean, garlic is extremely winter tolerant.
Uh-huh. So basically, I can use these smaller ones and just stick them in the ground and see
right,
what
and then what a lot of growers do is they grow them. They will start them either in the late summer or fall, and they'll let them sprout, and then they'll actually they'll mulch them over with straw,
uh-huh.
And then they'll pull away the straw in the springtime, and then the garlic will come up. I mean, the size of those cloves is not going to be a reflection of the size of the plant at all. I mean, those just simply happen to be either inner. Probably inner cloves, right? That were just happened to be a little bit smaller, but
right.
That's not reflecting the genetics of the plant at all. So don't be concerned about that.
But they'll have enough energy in them to get going.
Oh yeah,
yeah. In fact, this is not a bad time at all to plant them.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Isn't that fun?
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call, Paul. Rick in Highland, we turn to you now. Hi, Rick.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I love the program.
Thanks.
I have a question about walnut trees. Early 70s through mid-80s, I had a beautiful garden, and then I just didn't have the time. I was traveling and my work and stuff. And in the meanwhile, seven or eight walnut trees grew up there.
To
be about 20 years old. I've been cutting them down. Most of them I cut down last year. I've noticed that parts of my garden are beautiful again, but anything within the drip lines of where those walnut trees were does not thrive. I'm just wondering how long I can expect. There must be a residual effect. Obviously.
There is a bit of, you know, I'm laughing here. I can only imagine if Irwin were here, he'd be cracking up at this point because we have some great stories about walnut trees and juglans. This, you know, the same thing happened to me. I had a garden. And let's see, we call it the railroad garden.
Uh-huh.
If that gives you a clue that it may be not on my property.
Right.
And a walnut tree grew up there, and we didn't know really what to do, right? So somehow that walnut tree was removed, and no one really knows the details of that at all.
Right.
We woke up one morning, and it was gone.
I understand.
And then but you know what I found out? This was fun. I was growing my tomatoes, right? And all of a sudden, the tomatoes were up. They must have been a foot and a half tall. They were looking magnificent. And boom, you know, down they went. And, of course, I was in tears, right?
Yeah.
But I noticed that the eggplants were not affected. You know, this juglans affects only certain, mm-hmm. you know, so only certain vegetables are really going to be affected by this. But I noticed that the eggplant that I was growing was not affected, you know, anywhere near the amount the tomatoes were.
Right.
So you know what I did the next year? Because I had to have my tomatoes, you know? I'm not going to give up. What I did was I grafted tomatoes onto eggplant rootstocks. And I know this sounds, you know, this is really not all that technical. It was really pretty simple procedure, and I did a little cleft graft, and I grafted. Yeah, this is how I produced my tomatoes. I grafted them on to an eggplant rootstock, and I was able to have tomatoes the next year. Now, of course, it's dissipated. The juglans has dissipated.
How many years has it been, though?
Oh, gosh.
It's been a long, it takes so many years for that to get out of the soil.
I did that about.
That's what I was afraid of.
Yeah, I think I did it I grafted for at least two, and I'm sure I didn't go in direct seed back. And then I rotated probably to either a cucurbit or an allium before I came back with solanaceous crops again. You know, tomatoes like
5 years anyway.
Oh, God, you know, tomatoes would be hit by everything.
Yeah, you'd almost have to go to a raised bed, I would think, if you can't get rid of at least for temporarily on the tomatoes.
Well, yeah, but think of how much more fun it will be to graft your tomatoes onto an eggplant. Come on, that's fun. And it, you know, and it serves the double whammy of eliminating any eggplant fruit from being produced, which, as you know, is not exactly among my favorites.
There you have it, Rick. I would go with a raised bed, or you could try the grab. That might be kind of fun to do as well. Jim Nianos, our guest, our vicar of vegetable, professor of horticulture, gardening haiku poet, here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim Packard, our producer, answering your questions on this edition of Garden Talk as we visit with Jim Nianos. Jim, Kathy from Presque Isle wonders what the temperature of a root cellar should be. I guess keep it above freezing, I suppose.
Right, as cold as you can get it above, but keep it above freezing. Absolutely.
So
I don't remember us ever putting a thermometer down in there, but clearly,
it in the 40s, it'd be pretty good, really pretty.
Absolutely, yeah. You want a slow respiration as much as you possibly can, but of course, you don't want your vegetables to freeze.
Yeah. Dan in Partyville, your turn. Hi, Dan.
Good morning. How are you guys?
Great.
I've been listening, especially this morning, about the late blight. We live in Columbia County, and apparently, from the descriptions, our tomatoes have the late blight. The fruit looks good, but the plants all look dead.
Yeah.
Will the fruits keep ripening on the vine? I've noticed a lot of the tomatoes are falling off onto the ground, and we go and pick them up ripen them in the house.
You know, the farms that I visited a lot of farms this last week, as I indicated earlier when I had the students with us, and I did not notice that the late blight attacking really the fruit themselves.
Okay.
So I think the fruit will be, edible and probably very usable.
Just you keep picking it up as I see.
Yeah, sure. That's exactly what I'm doing. My garden was not really hit by late blight. I was hit by early blight.
Yeah.
I got
some early blight too.
Yeah, I was hit much more early in the season, and a lot of my fruit have little sort of halo-like darkened spots on them.
Yeah, but I was looking for that, and I didn't really see that. They just
look, see,
the
I
plant,
don't,
the plant
but you
four,
know.
They look good, and then 4 days later, they all look like dead.
But the vines, the late blight just knocks them out. Bang.
It's just like one week
to the next, they're gone. But the fruit seem to be okay.
Okay, another question. I've got 24 tomato plants, and half of them have the blight. And then I've got two rows of assorted peppers. Some of those leaves are starting to turn yellow, and there's little black holes in some of the fruit.
Oh, that's probably another disease. That's probably the the black spot. I think it's called I forget the actual species of that. But the late blight is very interesting. We saw it in any number of gardens because again we had the garden tour of southern Wisconsin over the last week, and you'd see tomato rows that would just completely, it's almost as if someone. The plants looked as if it were just after the first real hard-killing frost.
Yes.
That's exactly what the plants look like to me.
Now, on the other side...
The fruits were okay, but the peppers would be right next to them and they'd be fine.
Okay.
So the strain that is affecting the tomatoes is apparently not affecting the peppers at all. In fact, it's a pretty good year for peppers.
The peppers look good.
They're not growing really quickly because of the low temperatures.
Right.
On the other hand, the low temperatures have allowed us to set a lot of fruit.
Yeah.
So they're not... it's kind of a double... it's the good news, bad news. They're not growing really quickly. The fruit don't develop very quickly, but there are a lot of fruits set, especially because of the cool temperatures.
Okay. Now, 5 feet on the other side of my peppers, I have some cucumbers, some burpless, and they were looking really good. Now those vines are starting to turn really yellow.
That could be squash, squash vine borer or any of those things.
So and it's then not you related to the
no,
late blight.
No, and the things that are going to knock out cucumbers are going to be, the mildews, the powdery and downy mildews, and probably the squash vine borer. Those are the things that are going to likely. I think that's completely unrelated.
Okay, I don't see any mildew or anything, and it's just that the vines are all turning yellow, and some of the mature fruit is turning yellow too.
Well, the fruit as they mature, many varieties will of course turn yellow. That's a normal process of ripening for them. The yellowing of the vines could very likely be. I'm getting a nod here from Larry. Probably a vine borer. It could be probably the insects rather than the disease.
You can check your vine. Go down, take a look at the vines. You might find a small hole down near the base of the vine. You can actually take a sharp knife and kind of cut in and slice up the vine to the point where you find the borer.
You can and skewer the little son of a gun, you know, too. You
take
them
out.
Yeah, you want to make them suffer.
Well, they live in the ground. Should I burn the garden off?
Or, they overwinter, you know, as a pupae, and this is why one of the reasons why you want to rotate, you know, cucurbits.
You want to move it around.
Yeah, you want to rotate. My rotation is alliums to cucurbits to solanaceae, so I rotate among the families in my garden. Absolutely.
Okay, one last question. Pumpkins. I've never grown them before. My pumpkins are all big and orange, and the vines are starting to die off. Are those going to last until Halloween?
Wow. Now, do you have those are probably cucurbita pepos, and I'm noticing a lot of powdery and downy mildew. Do you notice the white powdery mildews on them at all?
No, I noticed nothing. Some of the leaves are still green, but the vines are starting to turn yellow, like they're at the end of the season. But
also could be, you know, the vine borer as well. That could be the insect, right? And those... that probably is what's taking them down. Some of the variety, one of the very interesting things that we saw in the garden, and I remember a caller called some years ago and asked me about this, and it was really highlighted for me in the field, was that there were fields where, you know, a lot of people are, you know, not fully aware that there are actually slightly different species of things that are squash. You know, we think of them as one big family, but actually they're different species. And in the fields that we've noticed, there is one of the species is Cucurbita machata, and the most popular cultivar in that species is the butternut squash. And there were beautiful butternut squash, and then right next to it, there was another field, and it was buttercup squash. And it turns out that buttercup, you know, I love buttercup squash, you know, those green, you know, they're great. But that actually is a slightly different species. That is Cucurbita maxima. And those plants were gone. They were out. They're not going to harvest. And the grower that we were visiting said, we don't expect to get anything out of our butter cup, but we're going to do pretty well with our butter nuts. And so that's that's all about because the machata tends to be more resistant to the vine borer.
Is there... If Halloween was tomorrow, I could have a great Halloween pumpkin picking party. But
Your pumpkins are probably pepos. That's another species.
Is there any way to save those?
Nothing's going to go.
Leave them sit.
Yeah, I would just leave them out there.
Just leave them sit.
The only thing that's going to hurt them, I think, is if they get a frost. Right? Okay. You want to pull them in before they get a frost because the skins can be damaged by the frost.
But can I just cover them?
Sure. I've been for a long time. I bet that'll last.
Okay, because they're gorgeous. They're beautiful. But
yeah, I've got my giant pumpkins growing up now as well. Yeah.
Okay.
This year we're trying to do a good job with those. We have to invite everybody, Larry. I've got a date.
Now, when
for
is
it.
Your
actually? It is
pumpkin regatta.
We're going to have the giant pumpkin regatta, and so everyone who's growing a giant pumpkin out there, I'd like you to come down and challenge my students. Because we are going to be on the pier at Lake Mendota. We're going to be at the Memorial Union, and we're going to have the Giant Pumpkin Regatta, and it's October 10th, Saturday, October 10th. And I'm going to have my giant pumpkins there, and you can bring down yours, and you can challenge us.
And so the October 10th, what time do you know?
Everyone, I think it'll be, I always say about noonish, and then it always takes me a little bit longer to set up than I expect. So usually we start about 12:30 or 1 by the time we get the first heat going. I think last year we were out there racing pumpkins until almost dark. I mean, there were so many people who wanted to challenge, and a lot of people wanted to challenge me, but they didn't fully appreciate how I'm deceptively fast when I get into a sleek sailing squash.
Thanks, guys. Have a good day.
Thanks a lot for calling, Dan. Appreciate it. So it's October 10th.
Yep.
And it really is a sight to see people racing around in giant pumpkins in Lake Mendota. Ruth in Eagle River, we're on to you now. Hi, Ruth.
Hi, Larry. I have a question about my tomatoes. There's some holes that are like 4 or 5 inches deep and about 2 inches across, and something's eating my roots of my tomatoes. Now, could that be a gopher or like a chipmunk or something?
Now, wait, the holes are in the fruit or the...
No, in the ground, right by the fruit, right by the roots.
Oh, and we could describe the holes again?
They're about 2 inches wide and about 4 or 5 inches deep. And they don't touch the tomatoes. They're just eating the roots.
Could be.
You've got to look for teeth marks. You know, look for those. Look for that little split between those two giant gopher incisors. That's what you have to focus on. Yeah, it sure sounds to me like.
Yeah, I think.
I think you're gonna have to get out the 22.
What am I? What can I do to keep them out of there?
Well, this is where you know. I mean, I know a lot of people do not agree with me on this, but I think you're justified in getting out the 22 and dealing with them effectively.
One thing you might do is. You could try what has been proven to be very successful on moles. You might try a rat trap and bait it and take a tub, put it over the hole, put the rat trap down near the hole entrance, put the tub over the rat trap, and you may people have been having very good success killing moles that way. They've been baiting it with bacon grease.
Bacon grease. I'm taking notes because my yard is here in Madison is, we have been taken over by these moles. And I am so pleased. How is this again, Larry? Let me get this done. You use rat traps.
Yeah.
You use and then you cover them up.
Yeah.
And with sort of a container.
You, and in the case of moles, you find an active, mound or whatever. Put a hole in it so that there's a
hole.
Then you put the rat trap with the bacon on it, or the bacon grease on it, near that opening, and then you cover the whole thing with a tub.
And you get one of those rat traps that really makes a clack, right? So when you hear that, you know, that clack and the little squeal, you can just
I don't know why
jump
it wouldn't
for
work for a garden, for gophers.
Oh, this like, oh, I am so pleased to hear this.
And then it's covered with a tub, so you're not... the cat is not going to step on it or something. And
oh, okay. Oh, I'm really into this. Thank you, Larry.
I did put a little cup of ammonia out there at night, and I thought if they smell that, they would be turned off and they would leave, but I don't know if it works or not. But
I was trying firecrackers. I was I was taking my machete, and I was running down the mounds with my machete, hoping I would skewer them. But I like that the rat trap thing I could go for. Yeah.
I'm just afraid it's a skunk, and I don't want to.
Well, if it's just one hole, is it just one hole? Skunks usually, a skunk won't leave a hole like that.
Okay. Yeah.
Cool.
All right. Thanks very much. Good luck. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it.
Well, her call helped me a lot because I want to deal with these moles. I'm going to go ahead and get some rat traps tonight.
I'll tell you what. Somebody had caught 12 on their lawn. And someone else called in and said she'd had them out for a day or two and she had 4 already. So.
Oh, wonderful.
Barbara in Fort Atkinson, we're on to you now. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a similar problem. I have a very small garden, and this year, for the first time, I planted green and red cabbage. Well, the cabbages were coming along just beautiful, and then now I see that something has, like, sliced off the top of my green cabbage. And I was just wondering if you could tell me what kind of critters would be eating cabbage.
Deer would, yeah. Where are you, Fort Atkinson?
Yeah, I live in the city, and I have a fence around my garden. So I don't think it would be, I mean...
Could be,
It's probably a critter, though, and it could be a long-legged critter that can jump over that fence. Yeah, I mean, if they're chewing off the top of your cabbage, yeah, it could be. But
it's be a raccoon.
Yeah, it's certainly some sort of critter.
Okay. All right, I was just wondering, because I thought they wouldn't like that. That's not very... I mean, it's a different type of taste, but okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. And on to Jim in Menominee. Hi, Jim.
Good morning.
Morning.
I heard your earlier short discussion about root cellaring.
Yeah.
And we've come up with something in the last 6 or 8 years of using ice chests, you know, the picnic cooler type of things, to store stuff like apples, cabbage, carrots.
Do you just put them in the basement, or do you leave them? You actually dig them into the ground? Or?
This is something that I came up with. It started out, I was trying to figure out a way to cool off my apples as I started getting more apples from my trees earlier in the fall. So I would pick the apples, clean them up, put them in the ice chest, leave the ice chest open at night out behind the garage, and then close it up in the day so that they were cooled off by the night air and then warmed up, or then they didn't warm up because they were closed during the day.
Well, that sounds like a root cellar. That sounds pretty good.
The secret is to get one of these little digital thermometers that has a remote sensor so that you can have the sensor in your ice chest so that you don't have to open it up to see what the temperature is inside of it.
Oh.
And we end up, to start with, putting things in there. We'll do a couple. Well, we've got about a dozen ice chests now because I buy them at the garage sales when I see them. But we'll do apples in a bunch of them. We'll do carrots in some. And my wife washes the carrots and trims the tops off and puts them into plastic bags. Years ago, we did some experimenting when we first got extensively into gardening, probably 30 years ago, and we did have a really nice root cellar. We tried to figure out the best way to store carrots. So we put them in crocks and plastic buckets with peat moss, with sand, with sawdust, with wood shavings, and just plain in plastic bags. And results were that the ones in plastic bags kept the best.
Oh, super. You know, we used to leave the tops on, but you said you cut the tops off.
They seem to keep growing if you leave them on.
Okay.
The plastic bags you use, are these airtight plastic bags, or do you?
They're just whatever kind of plastic bags we get.
But you don't seal them tight?
No.
No, you don't seal them tight. You just kind of wrap them
in. So probably leaves the humidity high enough so that they don't become dehydrated, but not so high that you're going to have the production of fungi and bacteria.
Right.
Yeah,
and
sure.
And of course, we're opening and closing them the first week or two that the things are in the ice chest. And we use separate ice chests for apples and for cabbage, kohlrabi, and carrots. Those are the main things we store in the ice chest. And we do end up, as it gets colder and colder outside, we take them from outside to in the garage. And if it gets really cold, if we're talking about a week of 20 below, and the garage is getting down below freezing regularly, we might move them into the entryway of the house. But we're able to keep an eye on what the temperature inside those coolers is with that little remote reading thermometer.
So you don't allow them to go below freezing. That's great.
Yeah, with the app, we're close to freezing is okay, but... So it involves a little bit of work moving things in and out, and keeping track of the temperature, but it's not a big deal. And then in April, when it's starting to get warm outside, we usually are down to a small enough amount of these vegetables and fruit that we can store them in our extra, we turn our extra refrigerator back on that's out in the garage and keep them in the refrigerator. And some years we actually throw away the last of the carrots when we start eating them out of the garden.
Oh man!
Wow,
so,
year round.
And I still have a few apples that are edible from last fall.
Oh man!
It sounds like you've got a technology that's working for you. And I like the garage sale approach to getting the ice chest.
Oh yeah, and most people have an ice chest.
Yeah.
And
we've got about five.
And in the winter you don't use them usually.
Yeah.
So this would be a good way. To maybe use them, and it's something that somebody in an apartment could do if they had
a
balcony or an outside door or something where they could put things outside to cool them off.
You have made our day, Jim.
Boy,
thank you.
Have I learned a lot today, how to control moles and how to use old ice chests.
Yep.
Yeah.
Thanks,
thank you.
Jim.
Well, you bet.
I'm really pleased that you called. I bet you there's going to be a run on these old ice chests.
It's going to be tough this Saturday.
I'll tell you that. That's a great idea. Jim in South Range, we turn to you in just a minute. I want to remind everybody, Jim Nehan, who is our guest here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking with Jim Nehan, who is UW-Madison Professor of Horticulture, gardening haiku poet, about the vegetable garden today. Lots of great calls. Thank you for calling in. And if you have not yet called, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Now let's turn to Jim in South Range. Jim, hi.
Hi, Larry. And Jim, a great show as per usual.
Thank you.
Boy, there's some just wonderful things that are coming up today. I have the end-all of all root cellaring ideas.
Ooh, wow,
for
let's hear
it. People. And Jim, the last caller, was superb. I wish I had a pen and paper write down all the ideas.
You know, I mean, superbness just runs with Jim. You know, and when you're Jim, there's just sort of a thing about, I think Jim Packard would agree.
Oh, no question about it. Yep, Jim in the garden. Well, I'll tell you what. There is a book called Root Cellaring. It's written by Mike and Nancy Bubel, or Bubel, B-U-B-E-L. And they've got a 300-page book called root celery, natural cold storage of fruits and vegetables.
Is this a recent publication, or is this something like the 20s or something?
I got it from a bookstore. Copyright is, the latest one is 1991, but I didn't have any trouble getting it. I heard it from somebody, and I went to a bookstore and ordered it.
Wow.
Yeah, Mike and Nancy, B-U-B-E-L, Bubel. And 300 pages of best ideas from building the house to incorporating into old basements, under garage ideas, and all kinds of ideas.
But I'm with you. I just really think that we have, I'm really serious. I really appreciated Jim, the previous caller's suggestion as well, because, you know, a lot of folks are in apartments, and you're thinking, well, it's really easy for me to, say, grow a root cellar.
Yeah.
But now now apartment dwellers can be able to store some vegetables, go out and get some CSA carrots or some potatoes or whatever, and keep them for months, right, in a root cellar. And I think this is just a terrific idea. I think we have to move in this direction.
I just went online, and the book is available. It's about $15. You can actually get it at Amazon for about $10. So
great.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Appreciate that information. We had quite a few emails. We better address a few, at least one here right now. We have an email. The emailer, David, I believe, says, seriously, my two tomatillos are 7 feet Ooh. Tall and have countless fruits, but they are small, like a big marble. I planted them on top of a mound I made from all of last year's compost bin contents. Will they get bigger? How small can I use them?
Well, you know, it's all about ripening, right? There's a lot of variation in tomatillos. One of the things we did last year, and we're continuing it this year, is that we did an evaluation of about 40 different land races of tomatillo. And what we did was we chose two that had by far the largest fruit and were, you know, had the great flavor. And those are the ones. I have seeds of those available. In fact, I have a lot of seed available of those. So if you'd like to send me an email, or you can do that, and I'll be happy to send some tomatillo seed along to you. And, you know, when they ripen is when the husk, right, which is the calyx, actually, it's the calyx that forms around the fruit. Once that the fruit will expand, it'll break through that calyx, and then they'll begin to really have the high sugar content. The wonderful thing about the tomatillo is it also has a very high acid content. So I think it makes by far the most exquisite salsas available. I think it's much better than a tomato-based salsa. This is the classic salsa verde. If you just, you have your food processor, grab your tomatillos. What I do is I parboil them, because there's a waxy coating on the fruit itself, right, as well, and it'll soften them a little. So I parboil them just a little bit, just for a few minutes, just to get that waxy coating off. Then I put them in the food processor, a little onion, you know, cilantro, a little garlic, and then, you know, a couple of jalapenos or serrano chiles, and you get a chile, you get the classic salsa verde. Now, one more thing, an important thing is that in the salsa verde, be sure to use lime juice, by the way. Okay.
And so he can, once they're ripened, it doesn't make any difference how big they are.
Right. No, it doesn't. And it's too bad that they're small, but that's a varietal thing. Some of them are, there's a lot of variation in fruit size in the tomatillo. And I'm with this caller in that, you know, you get tired harvesting those. It's like harvesting raspberries, you know? Yeah. I mean, you work all morning and you get like a cup and a half, you know, and that happens with tomatillo. So I'm looking for softball size. And that's what we've got now.
He made up a haiku about it.
Oh, God bless him.
Huge tomatillos, 7 feet tall, many fruits, salsa verde, yes.
Salsa verde. See, he was right with me on that one. Oh, God bless him.
I'll let you let you keep that.
I can keep that.
Here's Paul from Sun Prairie. Says, I think my pumpkins have powdery mildew. The leaves have gotten a white residue on them, and most have died. I have 6 pumpkins I want to ripen. Do I have to worry about them ripening, and what do I need to do for next year's planting? Will the powdery mildew be back?
Yeah, well, powdery mildew will be back, but I think that's probably airborne, not soil-borne, and it's always going to be there. It just happens to be a year in which I've noticed a lot of it on many of the pumpkins as well as some of the winter squashes.
Will the pumpkins ripen yet anymore?
Sure.
Okay. Yeah.
So I bet they'll be fine, actually.
All right, let's go to Don.
I mean, as long as the pumpkins themselves are not deformed, I mean, there are some diseases that will actually, you know, invade the pumpkin itself. But as long as they look healthy, of course, they'll ripen.
Don in Wausau, we're on to you now. Hi, Don.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
A couple things. First, I want to comment on growing garlic. I live near a CSA farmer who grows hundreds and hundreds of pounds of garlic, and he sells it to people in Texas for seed, so I think he knows what he's doing. And he has always planted it like the first week in October, about an inch deep. And I got some seed from him last year and tried it, and it worked really well. I planted it in the first week in October and harvest the middle of July. I didn't put any straw in for the winter or anything. And
you didn't over the winter? You didn't put any? I put straw over the top. I just want to baby them. But, you know, isn't it fun that we can grow a vegetable start a vegetable in the fall? My other big thrill comes after planting my garlic, right, in the fall. My other big thrill is that cold, blistery February. In the middle of February is when I start my leeks. You know, and my whole summer begins on the coldest, you know, most blustery day in February when I'm planting my leeks. So that's always a joy for me as well.
Okay, my other question is, one is about pumpkins. I planted some pumpkins, and my vines are like 25 feet long, some of them, lots of blossoms, but hardly any pumpkins, one or two pumpkins only. Any ideas on that?
Woo, I don't know.
The blossoms just don't go into pumpkins. They just, I don't know, they just fall off or something, but there's...
I don't know. It's not a problem that I've seen, that I've observed this year. You know, I mean, obviously they have to be cross-pollinated. So if it was some reason why you were not affecting the insect or the bee populations, that might be a factor. But it's not something that I've viewed a lot of gardens in the last week, and that's not something I've observed.
If you had a dry garden, would the flowers abort? I mean, they would abort.
If they were fertilized, they would abort. Yes, that's true. I mean, if you had variation in moisture content, because certainly we're not having variation in temperature.
No.
Okay. The other question about broccoli, my plants are just enormous. And they look like they're going to start forming the broccoli, and it just turns into the flower and seeds. It just bypasses the broccoli part.
Well, I think, you know what I would do? I would just cut them off. You know what I mean? I would cut them off because this is going to be a better vegetable for you going into the fall, right? Mm-hmm. So I tell you what I'd do. I did this with my spring broccoli. I actually, you know, nursed it through the summer. By just cutting off, I just took my machete and just cut off the actual broccoli. And I'm expecting that they will set, you know, lovely broccoli florets. What it will probably not do is set one central broccoli floret. I mean, you're going to get lateral buds that are going to be producing your florets. But I'm actually letting mine go into the fall.
Okay.
So during the summer, broccoli is a really tough vegetable to grow during the summer. But I think as you go into the fall, I think you're going to find that it'll work fine.
Is that because it doesn't like the heat?
It's all about the speed of, broccoli doesn't require any vernalization in order to flower. And it's all about the summer heat. Yeah, they're just moving too quickly. But I think as you go into the fall, you'll find that they will form. But again, it's going to form little broccoli florets on the lateral branches, right? You aren't going to get that main stem broccoli.
That'd be fine.
Yeah, that's. Yeah. I'm fine with that, too.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. And we've got an email sent via phone from Sue Nitzke, our UW Extension Nutritional Scientist, who's been a regular guest on this program. And she mentions to us that Barb Ingham told her that tomatoes from blight tomatoes may not have a low enough pH for standard canning. Hmm. So Sue was hoping that we would promote a publication. It's a UW Extension publication. I do want to mention it's called Tomatoes Tart and Tasty. Tomatoes Tart and Tasty, and I believe we have it in our UW Extension. Go to the Learning Store, UW Extension. You can find it. It has some great information on canning. Plus, it has some other recipes for canning and using tomatoes. But with this blight, the pH on those tomatoes may not be low enough for the standard canning. And so you really do want to take a look at Tomatoes Tart and Tasty. It's a publication from UW Extension. You can go to it online. I think you can get it for free. Or if you're by your county extension office, you can stop by your county extension office and get a copy of it. On this edition of Garden Talk, we're visiting with Jim Nienhuis. Jim, a UW Madison professor of horticulture and gardening haiku poet, here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Net. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Jim Nienhuis, UW Madison professor of horticulture, gardening, haiku poet. Debbie in Loganville has been waiting a long time, so let's go. Yeah, let's go to Debbie. Hi, Debbie.
Hi. I have a packet of yellow Jubilee tomato seeds that was packed for 2003, and in the early years they produced regular type yellow tomatoes, and then last year some of the plants produced paste, like yellow paste tomatoes, instead of the usual juicy spherical tomatoes.
Some of them, and this was out of the same...
the same packet.
Okay, yeah,
and
I can see that happening.
So I saved some of those yellow paste seeds, and I planted them this year, and some of the plants are producing a combination, I mean, both spherical tomatoes and paste-type tomatoes.
And they're yellow? Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, they're all yellow, but they're producing both kinds of tomatoes.
Well, you know, it had to be a seed mixture,
yeah.
Right? I mean, there's no... I mean, they wouldn't... The genetics was not changed by time, right?
But this is one seed that is now producing both types. One plant from one seed that
That is different.
Okay.
And they'd never, you know, the other years, they'd never produced paste-type tomatoes until last year.
One plant is producing both types of tomatoes. It's producing a small spherical yellow fruit, is that correct?
Yes.
As well as a larger
regular
plum tomato.
Tomatoes, uh-huh.
Be sure to have you gotten pictures of this? you should be taking some photos of this.
This is definitely a weird one. Okay.
Yeah, and they you know, before last year, these were packed for 2003.
Well, you definitely do. One thing I can be certain of is you do not want to make any sauce out of those yellow tomatoes. Can you imagine what that would look like?
Oh, yeah.
No, it's just the color. I'm sure it's safe. I don't want to have Barg Ingram calling us up saying, no, the pH is not going to be wrong.
pH on these yellow tomatoes.
No, I remember when I was working with a company and we were developing tomato varieties that had very, very high vitamin A content, right? So they had higher levels of carotenoids. And one of the things that would happen with the paste was, you know, that's some of the carotenoids, you know, have different, I mean, some are yellow orange, right? Like beta carotene.
Yeah.
And some are, you know, the lycopene is red. Well, these were actually very, very high in the beta carotene. So they were, you know, quote unquote, more nutritious, higher antioxidant, but they were very orange. And when you would make sauce or paste out of it, I had young children at the time, and there was I don't think I have to go into any depth here, do I?
Well,
but I think the yellow tomato paste would be pretty be.
It's amazing to me though that I don't know how you get two.
I bet it's got to be two different plants.
No, it
isn't. It's one plant, huh?
Plant.
Well, you got to take pictures and send these in to the National Academy of Science.
Send them in to us too. Send them in to me.
Because
I would love to see some of a picture.
Okay, what is your email?
my email is meiller.
Okay.
@wisc.edu.
Okay.
I want to see those because
she's got to send some seeds. I will send her seeds of my tomato, my famous 1x10. If she'll send us some seeds of her tomato, we'll grow them out next year, and we'll see what it looks like. It'll be fun.
Okay.
It's science.
And who is that?
Jim Nienhuis.
Okay.
So you can send it to Jim. What's this?
Oh, my email is just my last name, which is actually spelled Nienhuis. That's Nancy India Echo Nancy Hotel Uncle India. What's S?
Sally. Sam. In any case, seeds will not go on email.
No.
Oh yeah, that's right. You can't send seeds email. Well, look me up at the Department of Horticulture and then just send them right to my office address. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I thought email could do everything, but you can't send seeds with it? I mean, that's the deal.
Yeah, I've tried.
I mean, you can Twitter, but you can't send seeds? I don't get it. What good is email?
I only have dial-up. You know, I'm out in the country.
So UW-Madison Department of Horticulture, it's Linden, is it?
Linden Drive, just University of Wisconsin, 53705, and I'll get them.
It's not 706?
It's 706.
It is 706.
Okay. You're right.
All right. Thanks, Deb.
I'll do that.
Well, be sure to send those pictures. I want to see those, and we will, if we might even be able to post it up on our
web. That'd be fun.
On our public radio website, too. Let's see. Carolyn in North Prairie. I believe you're next. Carolyn, hi.
Good morning. I want to tell Jim how wonderful his peppers are.
Oh, good.
I have about a dozen per plant. I have 5 plants. I have about 4 inches of straw over the plants, and they're very tasty.
Oh, Carolyn, thank you very much. Yeah, so you're growing some Wisconsin Wowsta.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
I haven't roasted any because I like them in salad.
Oh, well, was it a week ago last Saturday that we were out at they had the field day over at West Madison. I had 4 boxes of, my gosh, there were a lot of people at that event, and we roasted. And I did get a lot of emails from people saying that they really enjoyed the flavor of the Wisconsin roaster. Although I visited one of the CSAs that's growing them now. And they did indicate that some of their clients had actually said, they were a little hotter than they expected. But I don't think... Now, Carolyn, that's obviously not your... you're not feeling that they're too hot for your salads.
I don't think so, no.
I mean, they've got a little... We don't call them hot. We call them happy.
And they're tasty, really.
Oh.
And the 1x10 tomatoes are very good. As I put them through my Foley food mill, there's nothing left but the seeds.
Hey, what is a Foley food mill? What is that?
Oh, those are nice. You must have seen a Foley food mill.
I haven't seen a Foley. It sounds great.
It's a contraption that you put them in. It has a sieve bottom.
Yeah.
And it has
a handle.
Pusher.
Does it have an electric motor? I'm really into that.
No, it's hand.
Hand. You give the energy yourself.
Yeah. Okay.
And even the Roma paste, you always have some kind of yuck left. But with these, it's just seeds.
Seeds left.
They're very good.
Mine was designed for. Oh, what's the name of it now? I bought it from this company in New Jersey, but it was a food mill, but it's a grate, you know, with a screw on it. But it's not called the Foley mill. I can't think of the brand name of the one I own currently. But it. I tell you, my arm gets a little tired by the time I do a bushel and a half of tomatoes, I'm kind of sore. So I was hoping I'd find one that the Foley food mill would have a little motor on it.
No, it's very easy to work. Actually, may I save the seeds from both the peppers and the tomatoes?
Well, let's see. The tomatoes are on F1 hybrid. Actually, yes, both are F1 hybrids. But you know what you can do? Just send me a letter, a little picture, and it's so sweet of you to call up and say how much you've enjoyed the 1x10 as well as the Wisconsin Wowsta. And
I've been keeping a track of when they're ripening and such, so I plan to send you a written report.
Oh, boy. And were they fairly early for you, we hope?
No.
Oh, no. Carolyn, don't burst my bubble. Okay. But
right.
Anyway, not early, but good flavor.
Thanks, Carolyn.
Thank you, Carolyn.
Appreciate it very much. And Paul in Cascade has been waiting a long time. Paul, hello. Thank you for calling.
Good afternoon. I have a follow-up question to my green bean problem I had the last time you were on, Jim.
Okay.
Three other people don't think it was a virus, including Brian Huddleston and yourself and a master gardener here in my neighborhood. They figured that it was a nitrogen deficiency.
Oh, were you? Was it? You had a chlorosis on them, huh?
On the very first leaves that came off of green beans.
Mm-hmm.
But not the subsequent leaves. And whatever it is, I got 19 quarts of green beans out of it.
Did you make dilly beans this year?
No.
Boy, you know, I am just addicted to these dilly beans, and I made 19 quarts. I made 21. You know, because I can fit seven quarts at a time in my cooker. So I made 21 cans of dilly beans, and those are
really good.
Those are really good. In fact, as we indicated earlier in the show, we had I had this group of organic and sustainable agriculture students, as well as one of their professors, and one of their professors just ate, and I think an entire quart of those. He just kept saying to me, Jim, these are good. These are very good, Jim. Jim, these are good. And he just kept munching away. He was a dilly bean guy.
Follow up, please.
Yeah.
About soil testing in a vegetable garden. How often should you do that?
Oh, golly.
About every three, is it?
Golly, I would guess at least, probably something like that.
About every 3 years?
That seems reasonable, Larry, yeah.
Three, and does it make any difference whether it's fall or springtime when you do it?
No. In this fall, you're likely to get an answer faster. In the spring, if you wait until spring, a lot of people send in the spring. And so, and people send in the fall as well, but I think you're probably likely to get an answer in time to be able to use it in spring.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. And Ken in Hingham, your turn. Hi, Ken.
Hi, Larry. Hi, y'all.
Hello.
Jim.
Jim.
Thanks. The reason I'm calling, I guess, is a couple of years ago, there was a caller on this program called in and said he had trouble with squash vine borer, and he heard that if you planted radishes with the squash vine or with the squash, it would prevent the vine borer.
Wow, I didn't know that.
So I tried it, and my biggest problem was with zucchinis. The zucchinis just start producing, and then they
get hit,
fizzle out because of the vine borer. And I've been doing that since, and I haven't lost a plant since.
No kidding.
They're nice and healthy yet, producing nice.
Okay, nice, I'm willing. You know, this is, I definitely, anything I can do to control vine squash borer is going to be a big help.
Now, I repeat that again. What did you do?
I just put a couple of radish seeds in with the plants when I plant them, and then the radishes come. And now this time of the year, they of course got big seed heads and stuff on, but the radishes are still with the vines, but I don't get the squash borer.
Okay, I'm willing. Listen, I'm going to try this experiment next year, Jim. Thank you. Ken, I'm sorry. I'm Jim. It's a lot of names here. Yeah. Today, everybody's named Jim. Ken, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. It's working out that way. But okay. I'm going to try the experiment. You know, off the top of my head, I'm thinking, you know, why? I'm trying to think, why would that exactly work? But there may be some bizarre reason why that does. You know, why they produce the same, glucosinolates as the other members of the Brassicaceae family. So I don't know exactly why. Maybe other brassicas would work as well, but I don't know. But I'm willing to try it, Jim. I'll do anything to control these little critters.
And one other thing I wanted to report on, I guess we've really had a nice garden this year. Everything's a little later, of course, but we're in southern Sheboygan County. And I had planted a sweet corn called Ruby Queen. It's like a decorative corn, red
sure.
and stuff. But it's an SH2, and it's a real nice corn. If anybody's listening and want to try it, it's, you know, the novelty always sells at farmers markets and stuff like that. And it's a reddish, depending on the ear, but some quite red, some mostly yellow, but they're...
Oh, that's really interesting.
And nice and sweet, nice, crisp kernel, good corn. And again, this year I didn't have any trouble with broccoli caterpillars. They produce
See,
nice.
I mean, you're taking... You've got the Zen approach. You're just like me,
yeah.
Right? I mean, I'm willing to accept a few losses, but if I can... But if I can have great,
organic vegetables?
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to go for it.
Plant a few more plants and let share.
Because it's going to be a great year for some things, and it's going to be every year is going to be great for something and poor for something else. And so I appreciate that. You know those red sweet corns. I've the first time I ever saw those was about 15 years ago. There was a horticulture meeting in Hawaii, and there's a plant breeder out there by the name of Jim Brubaker, a real, one of those great, classic guys. And he was doing vegetables, and he was growing red sweet corns. And I think that's my doggone phone that I'm going to turn off right now, Jim.
and his name was Jim. So
yeah, and it was another Jim, so he's a cool guy.
Oh, thanks a lot, Ken, for calling. Appreciate it. Britta in Shorewood wonders why her carrots and broccoli get floppy within one day of harvesting.
Carrots and?
And broccoli, they get kind of floppy within one day of harvesting. Can this be prevented? I'm not sure what she means by floppy.
Well, they must lose their turgor pressure, right, is what's happening, of course.
Yeah.
So, I mean, obviously the leaves are not going to be able to maintain that turgor once they're harvested. No, I don't think there is any way to do that other than to put them in, a very high humidity environment.
Yeah. I have another email here from Cheryl. I have something eating my beets. Big chunks nibbled out of the bulb of the beet below the surface of the soil. Also bites out of cucumbers and summer squash. Beans are chewed. The garden's fenced in. No signs of tracks or scat. I live trapped to no avail. I realize this could be a different creatures eating different crops. Especially interested in knowing what's getting the beets. Could be a squirrel,
I mean, Larry, I would say that probably your solution is a great one. Let's put out the rat traps under. Now, what do we do? Put bacon drippings over that rat trap, and then we put it under a bushel basket, and we're going to catch whatever critter it is that's eating her roots. Right. I'm feeling good about this.
It'll
prevent all those, people who get upset with me when I propose the other solution, which we're not going to go into detail on right now, but does involve gunfire.
Bruce in West Milwaukee, we're on to you now. Hi, Bruce.
Hi there, Jim and Larry. I have a very small yard in a very urban community, and I planted cantaloupe and zucchini and summer squash and
it can't be that small. Bruce.
What?
I mean, it can't be that small of a yard. You've put in a lot of
cucumbers. Well, there's only one or two of each. And what happened was that 3 weeks ago, the summer squash and the zucchinis just turned white with mold, and the cantaloupe and the cucumber are not. And I wondered what happened.
Well, this is the powdery
mildew.
Mildew. Yeah,
they're all covered with white.
Right.
Now.
Yeah.
Powdery
the leaves
mildew.
Just to be covered with them, and then of course it'll attack the plant. And boy, what's the solution to that problem? I mean, there are some sprays, but I don't.
Should I just cut the leaves off?
I would. You know what? I would cut the leaves right off.
But then
get them out of there.
And but the other question is, how come it didn't go to the cucumber and the cantaloupe?
You know, it could have been a timing issue. I mean, where you're going to get powdery mildew, you're going to get it when the plants are starting to be stressed. It could have been, there's subtleties in the garden that are going on, right? I mean, it could have been that you had a real load of zucchini on those zucchini plants. So then when the powdery mildew hit, it just, it was the perfect plant, environment for them. Whereas it could have been timing. Your plants were more vigorous; they were healthier. On your cucumbers, and powdery mildew just didn't have a chance to get a foothold.
The summer squash was very productive, and then the zucchini was the next productive, and then the cucumbers. So maybe you're right. Maybe they were very stressed because they were producing, and the timing was right for the mildew, but.
Yeah, there's a lot of subtleties out there, with regards to when, diseases hit. We talked about this earlier when we talked about the fact that why do we have you know, this this late blight this year. It's because we have the perfect storm this year.
Yeah.
Susceptible to varieties. We've got a new strain of the, apparently a new strain of the fungus out there. And then what do we get? All of a sudden, Wisconsin became Southern Ireland this year. I mean, it was cool and wet.
Yeah. Okay.
All right.
Well, I'll just cut the leaves off and see what happens.
You know, they you know what they'll often recover. I mean, you can get the secondary growth will come back and it'll be healthy.
So cut those off. And we had an email from someone about the cabbages with the tops. This person says, my guess is that nothing is eating the tops of her cabbage. When they get very mature, the cabbage will split. It looks like something ate the middle out of it, but that's not the
case.
Is
that right? Okay, you know, it could be that the cabbages are doing so well this year. I mean, I've seen cabbages out there that are, I mean, they must be 50 pounds.
Yeah.
I mean, they are incredible. That's a very good point. It could be that they're, and when they imbibe water, they will split. Yep. That's a possibility.
This caller, this emailer said, when I was a kid, my dad always said we have to pick the cabbages before they bust.
Wow. This is the year for it. If there's a year where they're going to have to pick them before they bust, it could be this year.
Bridget and Seymour, hello.
Hi. I also have leaf conditions. Not conditions so much as I was, have you ever heard of just cutting the tomato leaves off so that the energy goes into the tomato?
Yeah. You know, I've never been a
big fan of that.
Never been a big fan of that. I could never quite understand that. But I, you know, because to me, you've got to be, you know, like you're, it's, I view it as a production facility, right? Like, why am I going to cut off the photosynthetic part of the plant and how is that going to help me produce more tomatoes? So I've not ever been too big on that. But of course, if you have diseased leaves, one of the ways that you might be able to control disease is actually by removing, especially with that Phytophthora, you might be able to actually remove some of the diseased leaves. Although, again, what are we having? We had, for the last 3 days, we had fairly wet, cool temperatures, and this weekend is going to be cool as well. You know, there's probably no escaping it. We could probably go out there and pick off every leaf that we feel is infected, and I bet there would be 10,000 more by Monday morning.
Unfortunately. Thank you very much for calling. And Becky Gutzman, who is a Master Gardener chair, sent us a little poem. Gardeners love to talk, vegetables, wildlife, and prairies. Join us at Ho-Chunk. And that's referring to the Master Gardener Conference. It's going to be at Ho-Chunk in October, and I just wanted to mention that because we'll be talking some more about that Master Gardener Conference. It's going to be a great one, and you don't have to be a Master Gardener in order to attend. And just to conclude here, John says earlier in the show you were talking about grafting some tomato plants onto the roots of some eggplants to combat the disease. This is the first time I have heard of grafting, getting rid of corruption. On that note, we close. Thanks, Jim.
All righty. Well, thank you.
Jim Neonos, he'll be back, and we'll talk with him.
One haiku. I didn't have a haiku. My callers had haiku.
Well, and we had some more haikus on the air. We just didn't get to. I'm sorry for that. Thank you very much for listening. To let you know, Monday we'll talk astronomy with Jim Lattice, director of the UW Space Place in Madison, Tom Hall, optics expert with Eagle Optics of Middleton. So they'll be on at 11 o'clock. And then 11:45, our weather guys, Professors Steve Ackerman and John Martin, will come in to talk about this crazy weather we've had this summer. It's been cool and kind of moist and sometimes. And, well, you know, stay with us. Lots in store.